Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and today we begin the show by talking about some new nut and fruit crops in Wisconsin that are being developed or are developed already. Things like hazelnuts, there's a new table grape, we'll talk about black currants and honeyberries and kernza and winter oil seed crops with our guest, Jason Fischbach, back with us. He's an emerging crops outreach specialist, professor with UW-Madison's Division of Extension, and he specializes in developing new cropping options for farmers. And it's great to have him with us. His work, I think it's been 2007, has been dedicated to developing a commercially viable hazelnut industry in our state and throughout the Upper Midwest through the Upper Midwest Hazel Development Initiative, which he co-leads. And what would you like to know about these new nut and fruit crops as we move along? I hope you'll join in. Are you thinking of adding any to your garden? Love to hear from you. You can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jason Fischbach, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be back. It's been a while.
It has been a while. It's probably worth reviewing a few things. You're part of this Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Institute. And just what's the overall goal of that and the work you do? You co-direct it.
Yeah, ultimately our goal is to build a crop here that growers can grow and make money and consumers across the state can enjoy. Hazelnuts are an interesting nut in that worldwide they're super popular. You go to Europe, it's sort of like the equivalent of our peanut. But it's never really been a thing in the United States, primarily because they haven't been available. The Pacific Northwest, because of Oregon, it's been a thing. But Midwesterners are finally discovering hazelnuts and they love them. And we can't grow them fast enough to get them. So, this is a huge opportunity for growers. It really would be our first commercial nut crop for the state, for the Upper Midwest. And it's happening, which is the fun part. I'm right now sitting in our processing facility up in Ashland, processing hazelnuts for about 40 different growers. Next week, our friends over at the Red Cliff Tribe are bringing students with the hazelnuts they harvested over the fall, and we're going to process those for them. Plants are starting to be sold by the nurseries. It's really an exciting time, not just for hazelnuts, but there's a couple other fruit crops that have had some recent breakthroughs. And it's
going pretty well. You know, I have my understanding, well, I know that hazelnuts have a pretty thick shell, if I'm not mistaken. So it makes it, and so the processing of them is interesting to me. How are they processed? And I think also Wisconsin hazelnuts are, if I'm not mistaken, a little different from the ones in Oregon.
Yeah, so the stuff that grows wild in Wisconsin, American hazelnut and beaked hazelnut, pretty small with thick shells and relatively small kernels, versus the stuff in Oregon, the European hazelnut's much larger and a thinner shell. And when you cross the two, you get the best of both worlds. You get the disease resistance and winter hardiness from our plants here in the Midwest, and we get a larger nut size from the European hazelnuts. And those species all kind of freely intercross. So just by doing some basic breeding, just crossing these plants, we can get some really interesting material. Now, it takes a long time to develop new cultivars. That's why we've been at it for 20 years. But we finally feel like we've crossed the bridge. We have what we now call the Adventure Series of hazelnut cultivars. And our nurseries are working as fast as they can to get those propagated and out to growers. In the meantime, you can still buy seed origin plants, which a lot of growers like to do. These are just plants that are grown from seed rather than from cuttings. And you get some really great nuts from there. It's just more variable and a little lower production. But
yeah,
so lots of options right now for growers that have never been there before.
Jess in Manitowoc, I think, has a question relating to this. So let's go there. Jess, hi.
Hi, I have a question. I'm not exactly a spring chicken. And I wondered if I bought hazelnut, if I wanted to try growing them, if that would actually, in fact, I'll get any nuts in my lifetime. I'm in my 60s.
Sure. Yeah, so the plants that are available from nurseries now, if all goes well, you'll have, if you plant in 2026, you'll have nuts in 2028, if all goes well. It won't be a lot, but you'll start being able to pick something. It's usually by the fifth year after planting where you start to see some pretty good production. The other thing to keep in mind is hazelnuts don't self-pollinate, so you need two compatible, kind of like apples, right? Yeah. Don't worry about it because there's so much apple pollen, but for hazelnuts, if you live near the woods or something, there's probably wild hazelnuts that do the pollination for you, but you do need more than one plant and they need to be compatible. The other thing too to keep in mind, especially if you're kind of doing it on a smaller scale in your backyard or a small acreage, is not only do you like hazelnuts, but so do all your furry friends, squirrels, chipmunks, blue jays. So you got to kind of plant enough for them and for you, because they will come in and clean you out if you're not on top of the harvesting.
Well, and they like them because they're, well, they taste good, and they're also highly nutritious, if I'm not mistaken.
So nutritious, yeah. They're about 60% oil by weight, and the oil is almost identical to olive oil. We kind of call it the olive oil of the north, and it's got a lot of protein, a lot of vitamin K, so it's a really, really healthy, just like all nuts, but hazelnuts in particular is a really healthy nut.
So how do you process them? You know, you've got a processing facility. How do you crack them open and get those nuts out?
Yeah, so it kind of depends on your scale. We have lots of people that just hand crack in front of the fire over the winter, right, from their own backyard plot. Then you can buy these small scale that you can run with like a cordless drill that you can crack out nuts, you know, for less than a couple $100. For us, we actually have some imported cracking equipment from Europe. We have some Spanish-made crackers that, you know, we can dump in bucket loads at a time, and in 10 seconds, we've got them all shelled out. From there, the hard part is separating out the shell fragments from the kernel. Yeah. So we have a bunch of equipment that through sizing and color, we can sort the kernel from the shell fragments. So
that's
definitely
good.
At scale, not something you can really do in your own garage. Which is why we built this processing line, to make it available to anyone that wants to use it, just as a way to bridge to where we have more and more producers and more processors.
Yeah. Well, most of us have a nutcracker, you know, for walnuts or whatever. So you got your own hazelnut tree. I have two trees you need. You're going to probably just... I like that idea, sitting in front of the fireplace in the wintertime and cracking those open.
And our website has some really good pictures and tutorials on some DIY dehuskers and crackers and things. So MidwestHazelnuts.org is a good place to start if you're thinking of getting hazelnuts.
Yeah, it really is. And there's actually some other good information just on the planting and that and sort of care as well, I noticed on the site.
Yeah, and there's a brand new website called MidwestHazels.com, and that's the source for plant material for new seedlings and the new Adventure Series cultivars. At this point, the ordering's not open, but you can get on the mailing list and be notified.
Kathy in Greenleaf will go to you. Hi, Kathy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I just have a few comments. My husband and I have been growing hazelnuts for about 15 years. And we started out probably with about 5 plants, probably have close to 100, 125 shrubs throughout the our backyard and such. And we only get enough for probably myself to make a few recipes of hazelnut biscotti, because we know when they're ready, the squirrels, the chipmunks, the blue jays are just swarming. The bushes look like they are alive when they're in there harvesting. And I'm really interested in, I didn't know that there was another cultivar, and we're anxious to try that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Something to add there in answer to Kathy, Jason.
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely for folks thinking about hazelnuts to keep that in mind, is the wildlife pressure is for real. Like when they're ripe, every animal, it seems like, in the county knows where they are. So being ahead of the harvesting is really important. And, you know, for smaller scale, you might consider netting, something like you would do for the birds, for blueberries or honeyberries or something. Otherwise, you just have to kind of plant a lot. So we just want growers to be aware of that when they get into it.
Yeah.
The newer cultivars, you know, higher yield, so that helps a lot. The older genetics, the older seedlings would be really variable. So you might have a plant that never produces nuts or hardly any, and then you have some that produce a lot. So the reason why we're trying to develop cultivars is so that every plant you're growing has lots of nuts every year. That's the goal.
And the varieties now that you're recommending and based on your research over time again are?
It's called the Adventure Series, and there's five of them. There's Adventure, Trail Runner, Forager, Cash, and yeah, I think that's, oh, and Ice Age.
Ice Age, okay.
Yep.
Kathy, there you go. Thank you very much. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and are those nuts going to be larger than what
yes.
The original ones are?
Yeah, so we selected those to have a larger nut size than the wild American hazelnuts. They're not as large as the Oregon hazelnut cultivars. They're halfway in between, basically.
Okay. There you go, Kathy. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Don in Iron River, we'll go to you. Hi, Don.
Say, fellas, I've tried to grow filberts, which I think they are a hybrid of hazelnuts, and I have not had a lot of luck.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jason.
So it could be a couple of things. Sometimes filberts are used as another name for the European hazelnut or the Oregon-grown hazelnuts. And generally, especially up in Iron River where we are, they're not going to survive the winter reliably. And there's also a disease called Eastern filbert blight, which all of our American hazelnut and beaked hazelnut have co-evolved with, so they have resistance, but the European hazelnut largely does not. So that could be part of it. The other part is the seedling origin plants. So in other words, they're grown from a seed rather than from cuttings.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're from a seed, they're going to be really variable from plant to plant because they're genetically different. And so you might have some plants that just don't perform well just because genetically they don't perform well. That's why we do plant breeding, right? To select those plants that do the best. So, but that's been the problem is that's largely all that's been available until now are those seed origin plants.
We actually last week on Garden Talk, we spent some time talking about the difference between seed-oriented seedlings and cultivars.
Yep.
There's a big difference between them.
Yeah, that's really important to bring up, especially with new and emerging fruit crops, because, things like pawpaw and persimmon, things that'll grow maybe in the southern part of Wisconsin, or chestnuts, kind of on the margin, but you've got seed origin plants or cultivars. And so as a grower, if you buy seed origin plants, you're going to get a lot more diversity, which you might want, versus if you get cultivars, you have known traits, known performance. But the problem, the risk is if you choose the wrong cultivar, or it hasn't been adequately tested near where you live, it might be, not do very well. So that's sort of the space we're in right now where we've got both seedlings and cultivars available.
And a cultivar, just to quickly re-explain that, Jason, what is a cultivar versus a seedling?
Yeah, so it's a named variety of plant or a named genotype or a genetic type that is propagated vegetatively. So each plant is genetically identical. Think of like a Honeycrisp apple, where they're all identical plants from one single plant that somebody found that was really good.
Yeah, there you go. Jason Fishbach, our guest today, he is the Emerging Crops Outreach Specialist with the UW-Madison Division of Extension. He's a professor, been doing this work on hazelnuts and other crops, berry crops as well, for 20 years or more. And we look forward to you joining in. Questions or comments, give a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at the research being done on fruit and nut crops for Wisconsin and really the upper Midwest, Jason Fishbach is the guy that's leading the group, is one of the co-leaders of the group looking to improve varieties. And great to have him with us. You can join in. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. A couple of more things about hazelnuts before we maybe turn our attention more to berries, although we'll certainly take questions about anything right now. What kind of growing conditions do hazelnuts here in Wisconsin really like?
Yeah, so we're still in the search for the Goldilocks zone, so to speak, of where they grow the best. But we have plants from the northern tip of Bayfield County all the way to the southern border. And the hybrids or the American hazelnut, they grow fine across that range of temperatures. Soil type, it's like anything. You know, the better the soil, the better the production and the overall growth. But we have it on sandy soils in Spooner. We have it on deep loams in the Madison area. So they're pretty widely adapted. Unless you've got, you know, like pure clay or pure beach sand or muck or something, if you've got just a regular old soil, I think you can plant hazelnuts.
I'm thinking about gardeners now, you know, sort of the backyard gardener variety. How much space do they need, or how much space do, you know, would you have to consider?
It depends on the cultivar, but generally these plants, if you let them go without pruning, they might get 10, 15 feet tall by 6 to 10 feet wide. We do recommend some pruning to try to make them more manageable. So per plant, that's roughly the size, and you need, you know, at least two, preferably more. So they take up some space for sure.
Yeah, but they can be suitable for backyard gardeners.
Oh, yeah, and they're actually really pretty. When they turn colors in the fall, there's bright reds and crimson and 100 shades of brown or brownish red. So it's really an attractive ornamental plant too.
And finally, you mentioned, I mean, of course you eat the nuts, but you also mentioned other uses for hazelnuts.
Yeah, the wood has been used for millennia, for basket making, for walking sticks. You know, there's lots of arts and crafts projects to use with the wood. But it's also, you know, just wildlife habitat. It's surprising just how many insects make their home in a hazelnut shrub when we harvest in the fall. There's walking sticks and katydids and tree frogs. And so, you know, shrubs often are a missing component in our wildlife restoration projects, and hazelnuts really can fit the bill there. So even if you don't care about the commercial hazelnut production, if you're really thinking about wildlife for your property, hazelnuts are a great addition.
Well, and we'll certainly keep talking about hazelnuts as questions may come up, but let's turn our attention to some other crops that you're working on. And maybe you can tell us more about table grapes. You're working on some table grapes.
Yeah. So, Larry, I haven't been this excited about a new fruit crop in probably my whole career.
Oh.
University of Minnesota has nailed it, their breeding program. You know, we've been in a search for decades to find a seedless table grape that would reliably overwinter and taste good for the Midwest, and they did it. Can't understate enough or overstate enough how great the flavor of these grapes are. So it's called the Northern Glow grape series. There's three varieties, three cultivars. Lumi Glow is a greenish yellow one. Think of it like Hawaii in a grape.
Oh.
It really has a tropical flavor, sort of a pineapple flavor. We've had taste testing trials with it, and people go crazy for that grape. It tastes so good. It really is a game changer, that grape alone. So that's Luma Glow. Then there's Ember Glow, which is a reddish pink seedless table grape. Great flavor. Personally, not as preferred to me as the green one, but a great overall flavor. And then there's Shadow Glow, which is a really dark blue, almost black grape. And that's a flavor. It's really interesting. You put it in your mouth, you bite it, you're like, And then a second later, like, whoa, this is amazing. It's got a little spice to it almost. So I think once people get a handle or a hold of these and start eating them, I mean, it's going to be a thing for sure. So right now, what I'd recommend if you're looking for these plants, because they're just now being released by the University of Minnesota. So the nurseries have just gotten the stock plants to start making copies. So you'll have to get on waiting lists most likely, but it's worth it. If you go to if you just Google University of Minnesota Northern Glow grapes, you will find more information. So far, as I understand it, there's one nursery in Wisconsin that is selling or taking orders for the plants. They're licensed to sell them. That's Hauser's Superior View Farm up in Bayfield. I believe they've got their website up now. You can get on a waiting list.
Houses as in H-A-U-S-E-R-S?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. Or Superior View Farm. And then there are two nurseries out on the East Coast that also are selling plants. So take a look at it. Now, it's a little bit, if you're planning to sell grapes, you do have to sign up with University of Minnesota's program called Superior Fruit Innovations. So you have to go sign up for that program, and then you get a basically permission to then buy plants. That's if you're planning to sell grapes. If you're not planning to sell the grapes, you can buy the plants without being part of that program. But so yeah, fun times in the table grape world. We've had these in our trials across the state. And so we'll continue to publish data on performance and that kind of thing as we go forward. So you know, Northern Glow, give it a look.
Oh man, that sounds great. Yeah, when I think about grapes or newer varieties, maybe Reliance comes to mind, and maybe Somerset Seedless.
Yeah, so Somerset Seedless has been actually reliable, but the flavor isn't anything like the Northern Glow.
Yeah,
and you tend to get a lot of smaller clusters. And Reliance is kind of a misnomer. We had it freeze back to the ground this year in our trials. Versus these new Northern Glows did not. So that gives us a good indication that they're pretty winter hardy.
Northern Glow. That's the way to go. I guess that was a poet and didn't know it. No.
Yeah, you might be able to trademark that.
Oh, boy. Well, let's turn our attention to black currants. You know, on a recent show, we had a lot of people call as fans of that fruit. And maybe you could talk about the varieties that you're experimenting with.
Yeah, so we have all the black currants, the older varieties that do great. People like them, like Ben Sarek or Titania. They've been around for a long time. The Savannah Institute recently acquired breeding material from the McGinnis Nursery out on the West Coast. And they did a bunch of variety trials and things, and they're starting to sell some new varieties. Savannah Zap, Savannah Zing, Black Cone, Whistler. And you can read more about them at the Savannah Institute website, or you can go to Canopy Farm Management, which is the company that's selling that nursery stock right now. So some new varieties, they tend not to be quite so astringent as the older varieties, a little bit more palatable for fresh eating, but really as a processing fruit for smoothies or freezing or whatever, black currants are hard to beat just because they're such nutritional powerhouses.
The other variety I was thinking of was Consort. Is that?
Consort's one of the older varieties, been around. Definitely not quite as good as these newer ones. So.
Yeah, that's why I guess I was remembering it's been around a long time like I have. What are the characteristics you're looking for in a great variety?
In a grape variety?
In a great G-R-E-A-T.
Oh, grape. Yeah. Well, number one is can they survive the winters for us? That's number one. Number two is overall flavor. I think, can you eat it? And do you like to eat it? And do your neighbors and friends like to eat it? And then third would be how easy is it to grow? That's the nice thing about, currants or the honeyberries, which we can talk about too. Pretty easy to grow crops. They don't take a whole lot of maintenance or effort. Something like blueberries, right? It's pretty finicky about soil type. Pruning can sometimes be a challenge, so it doesn't work everywhere. Whereas like black currants and honeyberries are more widely adapted. So that's what we look for.
Several emails. Ryan in Washburn emailed to ask that with increasing energy demand, what types of low-maintenance edible crops are best suited for agrovoltaic systems in northern Wisconsin, systems in which agricultural production is intentionally combined with solar installations, allowing crops to grow beneath or alongside photovoltaic arrays?
Yeah. So generally, we're looking for something that relatively easy to manage. So you don't have to be in there a lot. So fruit crops can be high management. So you want a really low input type fruit crop. So that's why there's been a lot of effort with currants because they are so easy to grow. The other part is shade tolerance.
Yeah.
And so black currants actually prefer a little bit of shade. So in terms of a woody plant, that's a good option. Otherwise, there's been a lot of work on grazing with sheep as a means to grow something or agrivoltaics. There's definitely opportunities for vegetable production for sure at smaller scale. So there are ongoing projects here at the University of Wisconsin and elsewhere that are trying to find the systems that work for both the solar companies or the solar installers and also folks that are trying to farm something.
Yeah.
Definitely an opportunity there.
Olivia emailed, excuse me, she's wondering if the cultivar's genetics could hybridize with wild Native American hazelnut, and is this a concern for maintaining native plant genetics?
Yeah, this is absolutely a concern, something we think about all the time, with lots of pros and cons and cost benefits, right? So we do, if you know, folks are concerned about it, there's definitely a potential that as the pollen's going to blow around, right? And so if there are alleles or something, it might move into the wild populations. Now, whether that confers any sort of selective advantage that they would be propagated and continue to grow is an open question. So the way to mitigate that is really thinking about if you're going to grow hybrids, you know, maybe that's farther away from wild populations. We're also developing pure American hazelnut varieties for folks that are concerned about it. And that would be a good option for if you're closer to a wild population somewhere. Part of this, there's a lot of questions we don't know. Again, that whole genus, because they cross-pollinate so freely and have, you know, well before humans were here, they're really highly diverse populations already. And so it's unclear whether we can actually put something into those populations that aren't already there, right? Just yeah, because they're so wildly diverse.
Kathy and Krivitz emailed to ask if hazelnuts need spraying or control of insects and all that sort of thing.
At this point, we're sort of in the honeymoon phase, which is true for most new crops, is that there isn't a whole lot of disease or insect pressure. But as you get more and more production, potentially pests come up. The one that we worry a lot about is the nut weevil. If anyone's wild harvested American hazelnuts, in some years, like every nut has a hole in it at harvest time. That's the little weevil that was inside the nut. It's a slow building population. And so with good sanitation and making sure you harvest all the nuts every year, it's pretty manageable. So we have plantings that are 20 years old that still don't have an issue, right? If you're right next to a hazelnut wild planting or something, again, you might have more insect pressure, but so far, so good. That's one advantage of a plant that has, you know, wild genetics is they're adapted to the populations that are here, the pest populations.
Yeah.
Carol, definitely something you have to monitor, though.
Carol called to ask how she can she buy hazelnuts that are grown in Wisconsin or where, I guess.
Yeah. As far as I know, there's one company that's selling hazelnuts online. That's the American Hazelnut Company. And they sell both hazelnuts that are grown in the Midwest. They sell oil, they sell flour, and they have a new product line called Midwest Munch. It's a trail mix made with Midwest grown hazelnuts plus some other fruit crops like elderberries that are mixed in within those trail mixes. Those are proving really popular. You can buy some, you know, if you know a neighbor buying in-shell nuts, but unless you want to hand crack yourself, you know, you're usually trying to find somebody that has kernel. So
yeah, and what's the name?
We see more and more sellers as the industry grows.
Yeah, and somebody is already saying, what was the name of that place where you can buy the trail fruit?
Oh, the Midwest Munch.
Midwest Munch?
Yeah, that's from the American Hazelnut Company.
Oh, American Hazelnut Company. Okay.
Yep.
Because I knew we were going to get questions about that right away because I forgot the name of it myself, and I assume that probably listeners would too. Oh, man. Pamela in Ridgeway, what's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you. I was under the impression that that currants in general were susceptible to, I think it was cedar apple rust or some kind of reciprocal disease with evergreens. And is that not the case with these new cultivars?
Yeah, so white pine blister rust, and there was lots of concern about, and actually quarantine's put in place in the East Coast. There isn't in place in Wisconsin. It's a disease that will move from currants, spike currants, to white pine and can cause problems. The commercial varieties that are sold are all resistant to that disease, so they don't spread it. They don't serve as an alternate host.
All right, Pamela, there you go. Thank you so much. Email from Mary. She has a few wild hazelnuts in her backyard. What can she do to make them spread? Or would it be better to plant a few cultivars near them? She's not looking for eating them, but for planting for wildlife.
Yeah, so full sun is the first thing. So hazelnuts, especially American hazelnuts, need full sun. And you can transplant them really easily. You can dig out divisions of those. The wild American hazelnuts spread with underground rhizomes. So you can just dig out chunks and replant them. That's probably the best way to do it. Otherwise, if it's just wildlife habitat, you can buy the cultivars or you can buy the American hazelnut seedlings. There are lots of sources, and those sources are usually pretty cheap, like the Wisconsin DNR, a lot of native plant nurseries. So if it's purely wildlife habitat and you don't really care about the nut production, I would definitely stick with the American hazelnut if you've got full sun.
Different fruit here. Sue in Cable emailed, she has had wonderful luck with aronia berries. Could you comment on aronia berries?
Yeah, aronia is one of those things that you don't even have to try and you get a big crop every year. Some of the commercial varieties, the two main ones, Nero and Viking, super productive, really easy to grow. But it's sort of been a problem because what do you do with all these berries? Because they don't taste very good fresh eating. In fact, most people spit them out when they try to eat them fresh. Okay. So it's definitely a processing fruit that you're making juices or fruit chews or mixing into smoothies. A nutritional dynamite for sure, which is why people really like them. But because of that really high astringency, we haven't really seen the market catch on for that. It's just not a fresh eating crop like other.
Yeah, I suppose jams or jellies you could probably make.
Jams and jellies if you had enough sugar, yep.
You need a lot of sugar, though. Let's turn our attention, because we've got a question about Kernza. So I know Kernza is another crop you're working with, Granted, emailed to ask how often does it need to be replanted? Also, is there more than one variety of Kernza? So let's just talk about Kernza in general. First, what is Kernza and go from there?
Yeah, Kernza is the trademark name for improved cultivars of intermediate wheatgrass or improved varieties, seed lines of intermediate wheatgrass. That's the base species. And it's been the dream of many for many, many years to develop a perennial grain crop, right? All of our grain crops like wheat and barley and oats, they're annual. So lots of tillage, lots of inputs. Kernza is kind of the first out of the gate as one of these perennial grain crops. There are definitely different varieties. The one that was most widely grown in our part of the world was MN Clearwater, which came out of Minnesota in a collaboration with the Land Institute. There's a fair amount of acreage of that. There are newer varieties coming along. I don't know exactly when the release date will be or availability, but the idea is each generation of new varieties has a little larger seed size. Right now, it's totally suitable as a forage crop, as a hay crop, for sure. But ideally, you know, ultimately the goal is as a grain crop and trying to get a little larger grain size, a little higher productivity each year to make it more viable that way. But it's definitely happening. You just have to be prepared for planting new varieties and like any new crop, doing your homework to know what the risks are and where things are at in the development and how best to plug in based on your risk tolerance.
Yeah, and I think I've read somewhere that it's the driftless area of our state would be, you know, kind of maybe an ideal spot for Kernza, in part because it's ability to resist erosion with the
yes,
root system.
That's exactly right. Anywhere where erosion is a concern, which is everywhere, but especially on slopes, this would be a great place for Kernza to build into grazing systems, hay systems, or there's been work into agroforestry systems to grow Kernza in between your fruit and tree crops while you're waiting for those to mature.
And I don't know if we answered, maybe you didn't, I just didn't catch it. How long does a Kernza crop last before you
have? Oh, sure. Yeah. So the yields of the grain start to decline over time. And so I've heard anywhere from 3 to 5 years is roughly the rotation length before you might switch it out. We'll see. Part of that will be driven by the pace of the breeding schedule. And as they're releasing new varieties You know, do you want to switch out your older for new varieties? But generally that 3 to 5 year range, and if your priority is grain yield, there's a lot of great research coming out every year as they try to answer and hone in on that question. So it comes, most of that's being done University of Minnesota, a lot of it out of Kansas. But in terms of most relevant to our region, it's the work being done by Minnesota.
Jason Fishbach, our guest today, the Emerging Crops Outreach Specialist, professor with UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Great to have him with us today as we talk about nut and fruit crops and the research that he and others have been doing, zeroing in on Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. Crops, berry crops, nut crops that farmers can grow, or you can grow in your own backyard, too, if you want to do it that way. Questions for him? Open lines now. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking about taking a look at nut and fruit crop options for our growers here in the state, both the home gardener and the farm community as well. In the next hour, we'll be talking with the author of a new book. It's called The Continuous Vegetable Garden, Create a Perpetual Food Garden that Sows and Grows Itself. And then just looking ahead further, on Monday, our physical therapy experts are back to help you with your physical therapy questions. And then we'll talk to the coach of the UW River Falls football team. They won the national championship in Division III. And I've heard the coach talk before, and he's a good speaker, and it's going to be an interesting half-hour visiting with him. Right now, though, questions about hazelnuts or berries of a sort or another, give a call. The number, 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. And let's turn to Tracy in Mercer, Wisconsin. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, tell me why this is the stupidest idea in the world. So I quit thinking about it. I did my graduate work in Adams County. I'm from Adams County. Could you put those hazelnuts in rows parallel to the crops underneath the center pivot every 100 feet or so as a windbreak and a harvestable crop?
Hazelnuts.
Yes, you can, and I wish we could do that. I mean, I wish more people would do that, and that's been one of our goals. It makes total sense. So it's what we call wide alley cropping, right? It would make great for those commercial vegetable fields, for potato fields. There's going to be some weed management issues to do it, but it would make a ton of sense to put that out as a living edible windbreak that you're able to make money from rather than just taking land out of production and still be able in the alleys to grow your vegetable crop. So it's a great idea.
And Tracy, I think, was saying every 100 feet or so. Would that be about right, or would it be narrower, or what?
Yeah, so generally hazelnuts need, you know, they should be, a plant should be within 90 feet of another one to be wind pollinated. So either have to have different varieties in that row, or the rows need to be roughly 90 to 100 feet apart so that pollen can move. That's the main restriction. But if you did double rows, every 100 feet or even 200 feet, you know, that works too. So there's different ways to arrange these to make sure they get pollinated.
Any information on that on your site at all?
So a good place is our nonprofit partner, the Savannah Institute, which is really championing deployment of agroforestry systems. I'd have to look to find exact documents, but if you spend some time on their website and their guidebooks about agroforestry, I'm sure they have information about, you know, commercial vegetable alley cropping.
Yeah, and we've had folks from the Savannah Institute on the show in the past to talk about that. So a good suggestion there for sure. One of the other crops that we haven't mentioned, another interesting one in my mind, and that's the honeyberry.
Yeah. It's just, kind of similar to the table grapes, where with some recent variety releases, it really has changed the game. So the Saskatchewan folks, University of Saskatchewan, Bob Boers has been breeding honeyberries for decades. And the newer releases, Aurora is a little bit old now, but there's Boreal Beast, Boreal Beauty, and Boreal Blizzard. We're starting to see more production of that. And it's just an easier plant to grow. The berries are a little higher quality. And it's happening. We're seeing a lot of interest. Our most popular podcast and our cutting edge podcast series is about honeyberries because they're easy to grow. You're picking them in late June, early July, usually before strawberries. And by then, usually the spotted wing Drosophila is not out yet. People like the taste. The newer varieties taste better than the older ones. Pretty easy to harvest, pretty easy to grow. The big issue is the birds will clean you out, so you do have to net them. That's the main downside. But yeah, if folks are interested in a health packed, good tasting, almost like a blueberry but not a blueberry, grow the honeyberry. It's more widely adapted than blueberries would be.
Yeah, I knew about the Aurora, but I didn't. I wasn't as familiar with the Boreal Beast and that Boreal series. So that sounds like the way to go.
Yeah, and we've got new variety trials that were put in 2 years ago at West Madison, Bayfield, and Spooner. And now as those come into production, we'll be hosting field days over in the summer months so folks can come out and see the plants and taste the different varieties. I think we have 15 varieties in each of those trials, so there's a lot to choose from, and which makes it hard for growers to choose, especially commercial growers. How do you choose the right one? So hopefully that information will be useful as those plants mature.
Yeah, and when and where is that again?
So we have the trials at the Spooner Ag Research Station in Spooner, the West Madison Research Station outside Madison, and then on a private farm up in Bayfield doing this research. So the same three trials at three different locations.
Okay. And there'll be field events at any of them, or?
Yeah. So the Emerging Crops website, if you Google UW Extension Emerging Crops, you can find the mailing list link and get on the list, and then you'll get noticed when those field days are scheduled in the summer.
You also mentioned in passing podcasts, and talk more about your podcasts and what people can find if they go to those podcasts.
Yeah, I think we're up to 50-some episodes now. It's called The Cutting Edge, a podcast in search of new crops for Wisconsin. So it features early adopter growers, researchers, others that are working to develop these crops. And it's a in-depth conversation about any number of crops. I think there's probably 15 or 20 that we've covered over the years. So it's a great place to get up-to-date information and also learn more about the pros and cons and risks of all these different crops and where things are at in their development. So it's definitely worth the listen. We had a little bit of a lull putting out new episodes, but we're back on pace now. And I see one that just was released on flax, and we'll be putting one together on the Northern Glow grapes here in the next couple of weeks. It should come out. So good thing to subscribe to and stay up to date that way.
Yeah, it sure is. You've done some work on winter oilseed crops too. I don't think we've talked about that. So it's certainly worth a mention. What are these and what are they used for? I'm thinking of canola is one that comes to mind for me because I've spent a lot of time in Canada, mostly playing golf, but I've been at the University of Saskatchewan and spent some time there too, talking with folks. Yep. And canola works well there.
Yeah, so winter oilseeds, what that refers to, it's a broad range of species, but you plant it pretty late in the fall. It grows a little bit. It overwinters. Then in the spring, it grows. It's like the first thing green in the spring, and then it flowers and sets seed really early. So you're harvesting an oilseed crop in May, sometimes even earlier, depending where you are. And what that allows is think of it as a for-profit cover crop, if you will. So there's been decades of trying to convince growers to grow cover crops, and the adoption rate is still 6%. Yeah. And that's just because it's more of a cash cost than a cash crop, because you just till it in. Whereas a winter oilseed crop, you're actually harvesting an oil-rich crop in the spring, and you can relay that with soybeans or other crops. So the one that's moving the fastest is winter camelina, and it's being used as jet fuel, actually, by the aviation industry. And Cargill is involved, and we're starting to see some pretty widespread adoption. It's starting to happen in Wisconsin as well, but it's been driven by the Forever Green program at the University of Minnesota. And this is one of their main projects that's really coming to fruition now, is winter camelina. Field pennycress is another one in the pipeline. And so this is, again, from new crop development, new crop breeding, it really can change the game of agriculture, because now we have a commercial cover crop, if you will, that growers can make money. And so hopefully we'll see much more widespread adoption of cover cropping is the goal.
Yeah. And I like that forever green approach.
Right. Or sometimes we call continuous living cover. So you've got a living plant in the ground all year long.
Yeah, I love that. What do you see, just looking ahead here in our last couple of minutes, what do you see as for new fruit and nut crops, let's say the next decade? I mean, you're in about 20 years. You got at least another 10 years to go.
There you go.
What are you seeing? Or what are you hoping?
I really think we're going to see some momentum on these new crops, especially table grapes, honeyberry, hazelnuts. I think consumers are hungry for something different. They're looking to diversify their palate, and ultimately they'll decide how many acres of this is grown. I think growers are definitely looking for other options to try to make some more money on the farm. So there's just, from what I see, lots of interest. And I think we finally cracked the code on some of the crop development pieces that's unlocking this potential. But it's a new crop. All new crops come with pitfalls, and we just have to be really careful that we don't get out ahead of our skis and get too much enthusiasm, you know, without having doing it the right way, right? Slowly scaling up, making sure the markets are aligned with the production. So all the kinds of stuff that keep me awake at night to make sure we roll these out the right way.
Yeah, I was thinking about I've flashed on some of the apple varieties that quickly became very, very popular. And then so they started growing the trees in a lot of different places. But the soil conditions, I think the difference in the taste has to do sometimes with the soil conditions in which a crop is grown. And that, you know, like apples, and that changes the whole darn flavor profile. Gala would be an example probably of that.
Yeah, this is why research-based information is so important, both generating it, but then also finding the best information you can before you make big decisions about, you know, if you're putting in these new crops, really going into it eyes wide open and having done your research.
Well, if you're interested in table grapes, the Northern Glow Series sounds like the best. And again,
absolutely.
And the of the honeyberry, just to line it up, what's the honeyberry that you're looking for?
The Boreal series to go with Aurora, Boreal Beast, Boreal Beauty, and Boreal Blizzard.
And the black currants?
Black currants would be to work with Savannah Institute and Canopy on their new series from the McGinnis breeding program. So Savannah Zap, Savannah Zing, Blackcomb, Whistler. To give it a try. Plus, the older varieties of black currant all work great too. So, Titania and Benserec.
Yeah. And on that note, Jason, I want to thank you so much. Gosh, this was great. I learned a lot. I think everybody did during this hour. Appreciate it. And you'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
For sure. These are fun times. Happy to talk about it.
They sure are. Jason Fischbach is an emerging crops outreach specialist and professor within the department. Within the University of Wisconsin-Madison Division of Extension. And it's great to have him with us to talk about this really cool, I mean, this is his career. He's been working on this for a long, long time and certainly knows a lot and is working toward helping you and I get some great new varieties. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to a new book. It's called The Continuous Vegetable Garden, Creating a Perpetual Food Garden that Sows and Grows Itself. What do you think of that? That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mehler here. And for the next hour, we're talking about a perennial vegetable garden. Our guest, Charlie Nardozzi, is a nationally recognized garden writer, speaker, radio and TV personality. He hosts, three radio shows in New England, and he's written many books. His latest is titled The Continuous Vegetable Garden, Create a Perpetual Food Garden That Sows and Grows Itself. Well, are you a fan of perennial vegetables? Would you like to know some more about it if you're not a fan? What other gardening questions do you have? We can, I think, take a whole pretty broad range of gardening questions here for this hour. Join the conversation. You can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Charlie Nardozzi, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're, you know, just from reading from your book, it sounds like you've been gardening most of your life. What, and you talk right away in the beginning of the book about the traditional garden that you were a part of. What did that traditional garden look like?
Well, I grew up in Connecticut with my Italian grandmother and grandfather. I had a farm there, and every time one of the kids, the six children, got married, they gave them a piece of land on the farm to grow their own, to build their own houses and grow their own gardens. So I grew up with all my relatives, a real classic Italian-American family, mm-hmm. on the same road, and then the farm right behind all these houses. And so I grew up with the vegetables, and my mother would always have her own garden, even though my grandfather, of course, had a large vegetable garden, among many other things. And every spring he would come up with the old farm-all tractors. We remember those, the big tires in the back, little ones in the front, and till the soil and turn the soil and cultivate, run the cultivator through it. And then me and my brothers would go out and pick the rocks, and my mom would plant her vegetable garden. And that was kind of the traditional way of doing it. And when I went to the University of Vermont for horticulture, plant and soil science, that whole idea of tilling and turning the soil and doing that annually, if not a couple times a year, was really the tradition that was talked about. But in this book, and more actually in my previous book, The Complete Guide to No-Dig Garden, I talk about why we'd want to be doing no-dig gardening, especially for a home gardener. And it kind of flips the whole premise of having to turn the soil on its head, and it makes us look at a garden in a different way, looking at it more as an ecological system, especially the soil. If I was going to start all over again, Larry, I'd become a soil scientist, because there's fascinating things that are happening out there. And what we found is that, of course, there are billions, literally in a tablespoon of soil, 4 billion microbes that are in that soil, in a healthy soil. And those microbes are creating networks that allow water and nutrients to flow better to your plants. So the idea of tilling and turning the soil is going to break all that up. If you don't do that and use a no-dig system, all you're doing is mimicking what happens in nature. If you think of a grassland or you think of a deciduous forest, when the plants die back in the fall, all that leaf matter or grass matter just lays on the ground and eventually becomes compost. And if you go out into a forest or a grassland that hasn't been disturbed a lot, you will see that those layers of compost that are there. So what we're doing in our garden is that we're not turning and tilling it. We're adding organic material, and we're adding compost, and we're creating a more productive garden with less weeds, less problems, and more fun, just less work for you in the yard.
So, you know, when I saw the title before I had a chance to pursue it, and I'll tell you right now, I didn't receive your book until last night.
So
you can imagine, and normally when I have a guest on with a book, I read the book carefully and note everything, and I wasn't able to do that. But my first thought was, well, wait a minute now, perpetual garden, you're out east and maybe in Connecticut where the zones, I know the growing zones are like 6 and 7. And
right.
Here we are in Wisconsin. We're mostly 4 and 5.
Yep.
We got 3 on one at the north end of the state, and maybe 6 on the southeast.
Right, in the corner down by the lake. Yeah.
But then You know, I think you're in Vermont right now.
Yes, well, I live in Vermont, and I've been here for over 40 years. So most of my gardening experience has been in Vermont, and we have a fairly similar hardiness zones that you have in Wisconsin, mostly 4 and 5, a little bit of 3 up in the mountains in the Northeast, what we call the Northeast Kingdom. There's no zone 6 here. We haven't even gotten close to that one yet. So a lot of these things that I talk about in this continuous vegetable garden book are things that I have actually done in our Zone 5 garden. We're not too far from Lake Champlain, which is a smaller version of the Great Lakes. Let's put it that way. But we do get an effect from that lake of having it a little bit milder here. So when I talk about a continuous vegetable garden, the idea is not only to use perennial vegetables, which I do have a whole chapter on that, but I also talk about self-sowing vegetables, talk about ways to save your seeds and plants so that you can have those plants come back year after year, and then using techniques such as succession planting, interplanting, and companion planting in raised beds, which is what I recommend people use for a home garden, to maximize the amount of yield you're getting, and do it in such a way that you're growing a variety of plants so you don't get that whole glut and drought that we know happens in a vegetable garden where you plant your 5-6 foot row of beans, and then in 60 days you've got more beans you know what to do with, and in 80 days you have no beans. And that's the end of the beans, right? So there's a way to actually, using succession, interplanting, and companion planting, to actually stagger that out, plant a number of times a season, which is another thing I really am a big proponent of. Even in cold climates, I can get 2 or 3 crops from one bed in a season if I'm smart about what I'm planting, and also if I'm really diligent about saying that it's done. You know how that is with people. There's a flower still left on the pea plant. I should leave it in there for a couple more peas. So accept the inevitable, meaning that that plant is probably done. Cut it down. Put some compost on the soil, and then plant something else. So that whole system is what I talk about in the book, and I really illustrate it with a chapter that has all these garden designs. So, for example, I took six different raised beds in a full sun garden, and I walked you through what the bed's going to look like in the spring, the summer, and the fall. So you get a real visual of, oh, I see, he's planted there, and then he's harvesting there, and he's removing that and planting this. So it really kind of shows you that you can have a continuous flow of food from your garden, not just vegetables, but herbs as well, starting in our climate, starting in May and going right into November. And that's not even including if you're doing row covers or you're doing some crop protection, too.
Yeah, a lot going on with I have to say, not only, you know, I did read carefully some parts of your book and spent a few hours with it. And I love the diagrams and the beautiful photos you have of your garden, which really gives you an idea what, hey, this is... Charlie did this, and I could do this too.
Right. Yeah, that was the whole idea with the photos. Yeah, many of those are our photos. My wife and I took photos over the years, and it was kind of an evolution because we first moved to where we live now about 15, 20 years ago. We had a quote-unquote vegetable garden, right, and then the flower gardens, and then the fruits, and then the trees and the shrubs and all that, everything separated. And now we've become more ecological gardeners so that we've integrated things. So that big vegetable garden now has everything else in it, including some vegetables, Bill, but a lot of other things. And that just helps the whole ecology, which is another theme of the book, of trying to grow more in tune with what nature does. And so having a diversity of flowers and trees and shrubs and perennials and annuals and vegetables and herbs all together creates an ecosystem that's going to kind of take care of itself. Sure, I get outbreaks of certain insects every once in a while or diseases, but for the most part, the garden is kind of just taking care of itself because there's such a diversity there.
Kent in Reedstown emailed us to say that he uses a broad fork to loosen the soil and pull out the weeds, and he thinks that's a better way than rototilling.
Yes, that is. That's kind of a transition. People ask me, how do I go to a no-dig gardening system if I've been gardening by tilling many, many years. I say what you can do, or if you have a real compacted soil, you can use that broad fork. Those are perfect for that. I would just suggest not, you know, stick them in the ground with those big tines. Don't try to turn the soil with them, though. Just kind of rock them back and forth to create holes. And then bring in your organic matter, bring in some compost, let it all work there. And those microbes will take care of that stuff, and it'll kind of loosen up that soil on its own. And then after you've done that, you may have to do that a couple years, depending on the quality of your soil, then you can just go to a true 100% no-dig system.
You talk, and you mentioned raised beds, and you talk about the various types, including metal types.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And it depends a little on what you're growing, perhaps the type of materials you'd use.
Yes, that's a very good point, because most people think of raised beds, and they, first of all, probably think of wood, a wooden raised bed. And what we have used in our gardens, our wooden raised beds, we don't buy cedar because it's very expensive here in Vermont, but we do have a lot of native fir and spruce, and that is not as rot-resistant as cedar, but is still a nice alternative where I'll get a good 10 years out of a cedar board, or excuse me, a spruce or fir board in our garden. So that's one aspect, is to use untreated wood, of course, 2-inch thick wood. That's thicker than the 1-inch you normally would get in a home center, one of those places.
Yeah.
Because, of course, it's going to last longer. And I also have these things called metal raised bed corners. And what they are basically pieces of metal that you can slide your wood into it. And what I like about that is that you slide it into it, and you four, of course, have four of them for your rectangular or square bed. And then that wood is there until it starts rotting. And then when it starts rotting, you can slide it back out again and put a new board in. That way you don't have to recreate your whole raised bed all over again when the wood starts rotting. So you have your wooden beds, but then you have, like you're saying, a lot of other different kinds of beds that are out there. And metal is kind of like the newest, coolest, hippest thing on the block. Everybody's got metal raised beds, corrugated metal or galvanized metal. You can even just go to a farm supply store and get a horse or a cow watering trough and use that. That would work just as well, as long as, of course, you have drainage holes in the bottom of it. The nice thing about metal in our cold climates, like in Vermont and Wisconsin, is that it heats up really nicely in the spring. So you can get out there a little bit earlier. The soil will heat up faster. You can start planting your radishes, your peas, your lettuces, your spinach, whatever it is. The downside of the metal raised beds is it heats up really fast.
Yeah.
And it can get really hot come July and August when we have those hot days. So you have to be, again, smart about how to grow things in it, and stick with the cool season things in April and May, and then come June or so, then you're going to want to transition to things that like the heat, the melons and the cantaloupes, okras, even peanuts. Why not?
Yeah.
But things that like a lot of heat, that would be a nice place to grow those in those metal raised beds right through into the fall.
You hit the nail on the head there, so to speak. A big part of your method is extending the harvest.
Yes, exactly. And we do that as well, not only by growing pretty hardy plants, but by using different kinds of row covers. And in general, those I think a lot of people are familiar with those fleecy kind of material that's white. You get ones that are just really more about insect protection, and that's another way that we don't have to be so involved in our garden, is to be covering plants and growing them to maturity underneath these what I call micro mesh covers, which are very thin. They're kind of like a window screen. Air and light gets through them. You can see through them really easily, but they block insects from getting into your plants. Where we are, I have a kind of an endemic population of swede midges and leek moths, which are the two things that I don't want to spray, because it's going to be a lot of work to do that. So what I do with both of those things for anything in the brassica family, kohlrabi, broccoli, kale, those types, I put these covers over them, and I just let them grow to maturity underneath the covers. They don't need pollination, so that keeps the swede midge away, and I do the same with the leek moth for my onions, garlic, and leeks, growing those to maturity under covers. But some of these covers also can be used to extend the season, and so you get some that will protect plants down to about 28 degrees, and then others that will protect them all the way down to the low 20s. It's called like a winter blanket, and that's something you'd probably use late in the fall when you're just trying to hold on to plants. You're not expecting them to grow much. You just want to protect them so you can continue to go out there and harvest.
Charlie Nardozzi, our guest today, nationally recognized garden writer, speaker, radio and TV personality. His latest book is titled The Continuous Vegetable Garden: Create a Perpetual Food Garden That Sows and Grows Itself. And we're going to dig more into that with him as we move along today. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here as we visit with Charlie Nardozzi about his book, The Continuous Vegetable Garden: Create a Perpetual Food Garden That Sows and Grows Itself. So, questions about the method or about a particular vegetable that you might have a question about or flower, I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Linda in Arborvita, Wisconsin, emailed to ask, what's the best way to control avoid tomato pests? I believe I've got avoid tomato, and I'm assuming it must be pests. They have it every summer, or I guess maybe disease. They have it every summer in their organic community garden. I wish I had that other word.
Well, we could certainly talk about tomato diseases. That is a common problem.
It's blight. I guess it was blight.
Blight. Okay, yeah. So there's a number of different blights. There's early blight. There's late blight. There's other diseases that kind of look like blights, septoria leaf spot and bacterial speck, a number of different ones out there. And in general, though, what they all kind of like is to have some kind of moisture on those leaves. So what I usually do to keep blight at a minimum is, first of all, look for blight tolerant. I wouldn't say resistant at this point, but blight tolerant varieties that are out on the market. There's one called Defiant. There's a number of different ones that are around. If you look in the different seed company catalogs, you'll find them. The Mountain Magic series out of North Carolina, I think, has a lot of good tolerance over the blights. They seem to help. That does seem to help, but it doesn't completely eliminate the problem. The other thing is to mulch well and to also be very diligent about pruning your tomatoes. When I grew up with my Italian grandfather, I remember him and his plum tomatoes, and he would have a stake, a tomato growing up the stake, and maybe a foot next to it, another tomato growing up it, and he would prune most of the leaves off of that tomato, and you'd have a stake that was attached by strings on one stem. You'd have a couple trusses of tomatoes, and that was it. And that's how he learned how to grow tomatoes in Italy, and that's what he brought to the United States. I don't think we want to go that severe, but the idea would be to remove those bottom leaves and do it early. I remove them even before I see any signs of disease on them, because that's where it starts. And once it gets on the plant, it's really hard to slow it down. But if you can remove those bottom leaves as that tomato starts growing, so you have a good foot or two between the soil line and the bottom layer of leaves, then you're going to be less likely to get those disease spores getting up onto those leaves. And then, of course, using mulches around there. There's also been some research using hairy vetch as a cover crop and doing the hairy vetch, sowing it the fall before, let it grow. In the spring, it, of course, will come right back again and start flowering. At that stage, chop it all down, really chop it down well. It should kill the plant. And then you can plant your tomatoes into that mulch that's there. And the hairy vetch supposedly helps reduce the amount of incidence of blight diseases. So there are some things you can try to keep it at a minimum.
Chris in Baraboo has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I had some issues for the last few years with leaf septoria. I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly, septoria. It's a fungus that grows on tomatoes. And it's very aggressive, and then I was able to spray it, and that was a lot of work and stuff, but it comes back every year. So I was wondering if you knew how to get it out of the raised bed itself. Is it really something that would kill it?
Right. So I think that's what you're referring to is Septoria leaf spot, which looks a lot like the early blight, similar kind of yellowing of the leaves with spots and spreads quickly. And I think that formula that I just was talking about for the blights would work well for Septoria leaf spot. One other thing you can do is if you use metal cages, a lot of people use either the round or square metal cages, you might want to disinfect those. Because some of these diseases, not all of them, but some of them can actually overwinter on those cages, and you're just putting your tomato right in the center of a potentially disease-bearing piece of material. So using some kind of bleach solution, really kind of wash them down in the spring before you put them out, and that might help as well.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, about if you wind up with a disease of one sort in a particular bed, because you're using raised beds, do you rotate the crops around from one bed to another bed to maybe help mitigate that?
Yes, that is the traditional thing to do. If you have a big enough garden to do that, that would be the perfect thing. Don't grow tomatoes or anything in the tomato family, potatoes, peppers, for example, in that bed for 4 years. So you're rotating it around, and that will help reduce the incidence of that disease that's in the soil, so you'll get less of it when you eventually come back to that bed.
You know, as long as we're on tomatoes, we'll take one more thing, because I was really intrigued by your process of actually saving a tomato plant from 1 year to the next.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Wisconsin gardeners were such experimenters. And I got to believe any people would get your book just to see how they could do that and then give it a try. Go ahead and explain why you would do that and maybe a bit about the process.
Sure, sure. So if you have a tomato plant that you really love, the variety you really love, maybe it's something that's been passed down through your family or a seed saver gave it to you, it's going to be hard to find that variety the next year. Or if you just want to get a jump on the season, you can try this method of basically putting your tomato into dormancy throughout the winter and then replanting it in the spring, because, of course, tomatoes are perennial plants. I got this from friends of mine who run a website called The Savvy Gardener, and they've tried it. I've tried it. It's really kind of a fun thing to do. So what you're going to do in the fall is you're going to take a look at your tomato plant, and you're going to be merciless with it because you're going to cut it way back. You're going to cut off 95% of all the branches and foliage, so you only have about a couple of stems of one foot tall with no leaves on them, because we want to try to reduce the incidence of disease as much as possible, and that's what you're going to have for your plant. Then you dig it out of the ground, knock all that seed soil off, wash it all off, trim the roots a little bit. They're going to be hairy and going all over the place, kind of make it almost like a little root ball. And then what you'll do after you've kind of cleaned it all off is lay it down onto maybe an old T-shirt or a piece of cloth, whatever you might have, and then get some either sphagnum peat moss or a sawdust, something you can moisten and put around those roots, and then wrap it all up. So you're creating a root ball from that. And then wrap that up with either a plastic bag or some kind of plastic wrap so it'll stay nice and moist in there, and put some string around it to keep it all together. And then place that tomato in a cool, dark place, like a basement, for example. It's something that's going to stay above freezing, but ideally below 50 degrees. And then you just leave it there. And every 6 weeks or so, you can go and check it, make sure the root ball hasn't dried out. And if it does, you know, give it a little spritz of water. And then come spring, come, say, April or so, maybe about a month before you're getting ready to plant things outdoors, pull it out, repot it into a pot, get it going, get it growing, get it start leafing out again. And by the time in May that you're ready to plant those tomatoes, you'll have a tomato plant that's fully leafed out. It's a big plant, and it's got a big root system, so it's going to grow fast. It's going to grow much faster than those little tomato transplants we get or we grow in the spring, and you'll get an earlier crop based on that.
I thought that was just the coolest idea. I'd never seen that before, and I thought, oh, man, a lot of garden. And you want to, you know, if you've got a plant that's good and healthy, a tomato plant that's good and healthy, you can do that with them.
Yes, exactly. And it is the healthy part is important, as you're mentioning. You don't want to take a diseased plant and try to do this, because that disease will be right back on that plant the next year.
Yeah. Well, so what are some of the best perennial vegetables to grow. And, you know, I thought perennial vegetables. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute. We have perennial vegetables practically in every garden in Wisconsin because we've got oh, let me think. Now I've suddenly forgotten what I've forgotten
well, we've
what
got
I
the
was
classic, gonna. You know, asparagus.
Asparagus is the one, and rhubarb is the other one.
Yes, those are the two classic ones most people think of when we say perennial vegetables. And of course, we love them. I mean, they're giving you food year after year. If you grow your asparagus bed well, you can have that for decades, continuing to mature. Of course, there's always an issue with weeds, but you got to do something in the garden if you have all this other stuff that's growing by itself, right? So yes, those are the classic ones, and I talk about them in the book. And I should be clear in my book, The Continuous Vegetable Garden, is that I don't go into a lot of detail with things that everybody seems to know about. Like if you want to know how to grow an asparagus, you can go into University of Wisconsin website or any different kind of website and get all the details. What I do add, though, is the information that will be important for you to grow this in a way that is continuous, a way that's going to be more earth-friendly, nature-friendly, and less work for you. So that's kind of where that goes. And I do a lot of referencing to other places where you can get more of the detailed information you might look for. They gave me a word limit for my book, so I couldn't write about everything.
Well, aside from asparagus and rhubarb, what are some of the best other perennial vegetables to grow?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ones out there that people really don't think about. And some of them are experimental as far as how they will taste for you and whether they be the best thing. But they're worth trying. If you like to add a little zip of lemon flavor into a salad, a spring salad especially, sorrel is a really nice one. It's hardy down to minus 30, I think. Comes back year after year. You want to harvest the leaves, of course, when they're young and tender. That's going to be the best flavor. But that is a perennial vegetable that comes back year after year. Certain onions will come back year after year. Bunching onions, like the evergreen white, something like that. I can't remember the exact variety off the top of my head. Anyway, there are some bunching onions that will come back. You put the bunching onion in. You don't harvest it like we normally would, like for a scallion, but you let it grow for a year or so, and it's going to start having little offset, little shoots coming out, so that in the spring you can harvest those and replant some of the other ones, continuing to keep that onion going. You're doing a lot more garden editing when you're doing this system than actually planting and harvesting and replanting and all that other stuff. And Egyptian onions, the walking onions. I don't know if you've ever grown those, Larry.
No, I haven't.
They're a lot of fun. They literally are a top-set onion. So at the top of the stem or the leaf, you'll see a cluster of onions, which you can eat. Or you can leave it there and let the cluster get big enough so that the weight pulls it down and it lands on the ground right next to the onion. And then wherever it lands, of course, those onions will root. So your Egyptian or walking onion will eventually look like it's walking across your garden because it just keeps moving around. It's a real prolific plant. I've had it for years. I use it mostly for those spring green onions, the leaves when they're small and tender. I sometimes will harvest the little onion bulbs, but they're a lot of work. They're kind of like with shallots size, so they're a lot of work to clean them up. But it's another fun one to grow in the garden. And then there are the perennial brassicas, and these are ones that most people are probably not that familiar with. Most of the brassicas, the kale, broccoli, cabbages that we grow are either annuals or biennials, meaning, of course, the second year they form a seed head and then they die. But there are older varieties, the original ones, the brassicas, many of them were perennials, and there are still some of these available, and you can go out there and look for them. Purple sprouting is one, nine star is another one, red arrow, the number of different ones out there that literally will not go to seed. And so I've grown one called cosmic kale, which is a beautiful plant. It's green leaves with a nice fringe of yellow around the borders of the leaves, and this plant stays in a bush plant form, maybe 2 or 3 feet tall, and every spring it leaves back out again, and I just pick some of the leaves. They're nice and tender then. Of course, by midsummer, with the heat and stuff, the leaves get tough, but they still could be cooked and could be used. So that's another example of having some of those perennial vegetables in your garden.
It's pretty cool. Let's talk more about self-sowing plants. It seems like you don't have much control over self-seeders.
Right. So this is it's kind of an interesting story about how I came to doing more self-sowing of the vegetable plants, or should I say, let them do the self-sowing and me just watch. They do a very good job of it. I have a radio show, as you mentioned, in Vermont, a couple radio shows. And many years ago, when I was a young budding horticulturist, full of piss and vinegar, I was on the show, and it was a call-in show, kind of like yours is. And someone called in with a suggestion on how he plants his lettuce. And he said, well, late winter, even with the snow still on the ground, I take my lettuce seed and just sprinkle it on top of the snow on the beds where I want it to grow. And lo and behold, the snow melts, the lettuce seed's there, and then when the conditions are perfectly right, with the soil temperature and the moisture and the sun and all of that, the lettuce grows. So I was very skeptical, being a young, cocky gardener. So you shouldn't garden that way, until I tried it. And lo and behold, it worked. So that kind of started me on this whole path of letting things self-sow. So not everything, but certain things. Leafy greens are the easiest and probably the most fun, especially lettuce. So we've been taught that whenever lettuce bolts, then it's done. You can't eat it. It's bitter. You might as well just rip it out of the garden. I don't do that. I may take some of them out, and I don't pull them out. I cut them down to the ground because we don't want to disturb the soil. But I leave a number of plants of different varieties to actually go up, flower, form seeds, and drop the seeds. And if these are early varieties, I might get a crop of lettuce in the fall because the seed drops on the garden, and then they start germinating and start growing. There'll be little lettuces, but I still get some. But mostly what I do is leave it there because the lettuce seeds will also overwinter, just like the guy who called my radio show. And so in spring, when the conditions are just perfectly right, it'll start germinating. It'll be germinating in the bed, in the pathways, in the asparagus patch, everywhere. You get lettuce all over the place. But then it's fun because you go out and you'll weed out the ones you don't want. You'll move them. You can transplant them really easily into the beds you want, and you haven't had to buy lettuce seed, and you haven't had to work to try to guess when was the best time to plant my lettuce seed.
Yeah, the seeds know.
Excuse me?
The seeds know.
The seeds know, exactly. Yeah. And I'm not going to try to double guess, second guess Mother Nature. They know when the right conditions are. And I use that as an indicator of when I should be planting other things. Because if the lettuce seeds are germinating, that means probably the radishes could be in. And the peas could be in, even before that probably. And some of the other greens that you grow, mustards and things like that, kale, could be put in the ground as well.
And when you're doing that, though, and then those plants, are you going to wind up with some cross-pollination going on?
I hope so.
Yeah?
Because what I'm wanting to do, especially with lettuces, is that you get some cross-pollination and you get nice variations in the colors of the leaves. So some are green, some have a little bit of red stripes in them, some are heavier red. That kind of variation is just a kind of a natural selection that happens. So if you're trying to save a variety to get that to come back as the mother plant the next year, pure seed kind of thing, then you want to collect that seed. You don't want to let it cross-pollinate with anything. Lettuce doesn't tend to do that very much, but other things will. You want to collect that seed and then plant it yourself. But if you're open to seeing what Mother Nature wants to create for you, it's kind of a cool way to garden.
Yeah, it is. What's the if you're saving seeds, what's the best, and you do talk about this, the best approach or the basics for saving seeds?
Yeah, so when you're saving seeds, of course, there's a lot of great, again, a lot of literature, online resources for how to do it for each and every vegetable. In my book, I picked out, maybe 5 or 10 of the easiest ones to do, the simplest ones if you want to get started in saving your vegetable seeds. Things like beans and peas and lettuces that I talked about, but even tomatoes, too. You can do those. They're not as hard as people might think. So what you want to do, of course, is have a very healthy plant. And save if you're doing fruit, like a tomato, for example, or a pepper, you want to get the healthiest plant with the healthiest fruit, and those are the ones you want to save. After they've pollinated, so after the tomato has been pollinated, or if you want to pollinate it yourself, then you're going to need to cover it so it doesn't get cross-pollinated by other varieties, because that's going to cause a lot of variations in what you end up getting. Of course, you always want to do this with open pollinated or heirloom varieties, not with hybrids, because hybrids will not come true to seed. And then once you do that, you let the fruit in this case, really fully mature. And then you'll take it in, you'll pull out the seeds that are in there, you'll dry them, and then you want to store them, putting a label on what variety they are. I've always forget to do that. And then sitting there in the spring's like, oh my God, which tomato was that one? I don't know. Captain Lucky, I'm not sure. Anyway, so make sure you put a label in there, make sure they're nice and dry, put them in a cool, dark place, and then you can have them till next year. And you can keep a lot of seeds for a number of years. Some seeds, like onions, for example, don't last more than a year or two. But most things, tomatoes, for example, peppers, lettuces, they'll last a number of years if you keep them in a cool, dark place and keep them dry. You can always do a germination test this time of year. Take 10 of your seeds, put them in a moist paper towel, put them in a plastic bag, and just let them sit in a warm spot but not in direct sun, and just see how many germinate after a week or two. And that'll give you a sense of how viable the seed is.
Charlie Nardiza, our guest today, nationally recognized garden writer. His book that we're talking about is titled The Continuous Vegetable Garden. Gardening questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk. Next week on Garden Talk, Melinda Myers is back with us, and she will be talking about selecting houseplants for every room in your house, and then we'll talk about how to grow tomatoes. And I'm definitely going to ask her if she's ever overwintered a tomato plant. Maybe she has, I tell you what, I gotta try that. I can't do it anymore now because obviously my tomato plants are all gone. But next year, I'm definitely gonna try that just for the fun of it. And the idea, of course, came from Charlie Nardozzi, our guest today, and his book, that fascinating book filled with great illustrations and photos. And it's titled The Continuous Vegetable Garden. Again, questions for him, give a call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. What about, you mentioned cuttings, but what about growing from cuttings? How does it work?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, say hi to Melinda for me. She's a friend of mine and another garden colleague, and she probably has tried this tomato thing, but you can ask her about it.
I will.
But cuttings is another way. You know, in the book, I talk about seed saving, but I also talk about plant saving, like the tomato, and also there's a way to save your peppers, too. You wouldn't put them in dormancy, but you put them in a state of suspended animation, where there's just a cool room. They're not growing, they're not living, but they're still alive. So that's all part of this chapter, as well as taking cuttings. So, for example, basil will be the classic one. You know, come late in the season, again, looking for basil plants or stems of basil that aren't very diseased to them, you can take a 4 to 6 inch piece of that stem, cut it just below a set of new leaves, and cut off the bottom leaves. And if you really want to be official about it and not have any risk coming that they're not going to root, you can dip the cut end in a rooting hormone powder, something you can get at a garden center very easily, and then stick those into pots. And you can do that not just with basil, but with tons of herbs. You can do it with oregano, with thyme, a lot of these rosemary, all these kinds of herbs you can actually take cuttings of. And then once you have the cutting, you can root it and let it get rooted and start growing. And then you have the opportunity to bring your continuous vegetable garden indoors. So if you have a light system, that would be ideal, where you can put your plants under lights, and you probably would get them to continue to grow if it's warm enough and light enough, just like summer. The basil, the thyme, the oregano, all those will continue to grow. But even if you don't have a light set up, if you put it in a sunny window, you'll at least get it to make it through the winter, so that next spring you'll have a plant kind of like that tomato that'll have roots on it, ready to grow. You can pop it back out outside and let it go.
Elizabeth in Platteville has a question for us. A comment. Let's go there. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I have a comment about lettuce and letting lettuce go to seed.
Yeah.
I let my lettuce go to seed, and it germinates in August, and those plants live over the winter, and I have lettuce early in the spring.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. And that's exactly what it does. Yeah. So you have it, the continuous supply of it. And you can do that with mustard. You can do that with arugula. There's a number of other greens that work really well. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Thank you, Elizabeth. Caleb in Cross Plains emailed to get your thoughts on tomatillos for permanent gardens. He gets volunteer plants every year, and they tend to be really vigorous with a lot of yield.
Yes, of course. So tomatillos, being in a tomato family, are another perennial. Yeah, and you can either try to bring them in like the tomato. I suppose you could try take your tomato and overwinter it like I described with the tomatillo and overwinter it like the tomato. I haven't tried that. But as he was saying, though, they do self-sow. So the thing with self-sowing tomatoes, though, is that, first of all, they have to be open-pollinated. And I think all of the tomatillos out there are probably open-pollinated. So you're going to get a variety that's similar to what the mother plant was. And, of course, you're going to have more than you're ever going to need. So it's good to be very selective about which ones you save and which ones you don't. People sometimes will ask me about the whole compost pile plants. You know, I threw the squashes in the compost pile or the tomatoes in the compost pile. And the next spring, I've got all these plants growing. Can I grow those? Well, you could, but you might not like what you get as far as the fruit from them, because a lot of that might have been cross-pollinated material. So if you have tomatillos, they're self-sowing. They're doing well. I don't grow tomatillos all the time. I grow them once in a while. But I do grow ground cherries every year, which are related to tomatillos and tomatoes. And those are low-growing plants with little Chinese lanterns. I don't know if you know the mm-hmm. perennial Chinese lantern. The papery husks on them. And inside of them is a little, I'd call it like a little cherry tomato. It starts out green, gets to a golden color. It's sweet. It's delicious. It's a great kid's plant because it's like a treasure hunt to find these. And it's prolific. And it also self-sows. So that's another example of one that I never plant anymore because it just pops up in the garden, and I save two or three of them and move them to where I want them to be. So if it's working, keep going with it.
keep going with it. We haven't mentioned pots, I don't think, at all. You know, if I was thinking about something that I might grow in a pot, it might be mint or
yes.
It might be horseradish.
Right, something that you're trying to not let it spread.
Yeah. So how often or how many pots do you use and why?
Well, we mostly use pots for, you know, we have a few edible plants in pots on our deck and patio, and we do, of course, lots of flowers in pots, too. If I use pots for keeping things controlled, for like mint, for example, I would just bury it in the ground. So you keep your mint in the pot and put it in the ground. It's not going to stop at 100%, but it's going to slow it down. A better way, though, for those plants that spread all over the place is to do it. I have a whole chapter in my book about fruits. And what we do with our fruits is that instead of putting mulch underneath the tree, you know, creating a tree ring, and you put the mulch underneath, bark mulch or whatever underneath it, I put things that spread underneath it, like mint, for example, or strawberries. I just use that, and that creates a ground cover. It keeps the weeds away. It looks nice, and it's good ecologically because the mint, of course, flowers, and that's a great pollinator plant. And when I'm mowing the lawn and a few of it escapes into the lawn, it gives a nice minty fragrance. So that's a good way, if you do have plants that spread, to keep them, put them in places where you want them to spread. So I have an edible hedgerow illustrated in the book that I have the design for, that we have strawberries underneath it. And so we have tons of strawberries. The mice get some, the birds get some, we get some. Everybody's happy because there's just so much of it, and it keeps the ground nice and moist, and it keeps it relatively weed-free. Now, if you're growing other things in pots, certainly you can grow all kinds of vegetables in pots. There's a lot of dwarf varieties. I would suggest, you know, the bigger the pot, the better, because you'll have less work to do as far as weeding, watering it and fertilizing it. And mix and match them. I show some different examples in the books of different kinds of partners and companion plants that would grow well together, putting an eggplant in one side and maybe some cucumbers cascading off the edge, that kind of thing. Or strawberries is another one. Those are nice combinations that you can do with the containers. If you don't have the yard to grow a big raised bed or a number of raised beds, you can have a nice little edible garden right on your patio or your deck.
Yeah. You mentioned strawberries. Other fruits that you grow in your garden?
Yes. As I mentioned, I had that whole chapter. I grow a ton of things. We have fruit, literally, fresh fruit, literally from May, June, when the honeyberries, I know your previous guest, I was listening,
yeah.
He was talking about honeyberries. They grow really well here as well. So they fruit 2 weeks before the strawberries do. So they're usually May, June sometime, depending on how early the spring is. And then going right through the season, we have a constant supply of fruit all the way till November, when our persimmons are finally harvested because they've sweetened up a little bit. And that doesn't mean I have like a huge property. I favor plants that are self-pollinating, varieties that are self-pollinating, or bush plants that are small and you can actually have a couple of them together. So planting things like that and doing it, and again, I have another design of how to do that in your yard, so that they're compatible with each other. There's a thing in permaculture called plant guilds, where you plant, say you have a fruit tree, say you have a dwarf apple tree, for example, that underneath it, maybe you have your currants, your honeyberries, maybe even have some elderberries, the smaller ones, if you can fit them in there. Maybe you have some pollinator plants. You have some other kinds of plants. You have a whole community of plants underneath this fruit tree. So you're not sacrificing space by trying to plant things separately. You plant them all together.
It's a wonderful, wonderful process. Charlie, I went to your website too, and it's talk about your website. It's filled with good information.
Yeah, I've got a lot of information in there. It's gardeningwithcharlie.com, gardeningwithcharlie.com, or you can just Google Charlie Nardozzi, it'll pop up. I have lots of articles, podcasts, videos that I've done. I do webinars. I'm actually doing a webinar on my continuous vegetable garden book in February. If people are interested in that, they can go to the website, find out more about it. But I have my past webinars. I have maybe over 20 of those that you can purchase and watch as many times as you want for as long as you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I have all that information that's in there. I have, of course, where my speaking engagements are. I do garden tours as well, to usually Europe and the United Kingdom. This year we're going to England. We're going to the Chelsea Flower Show, the classic.
Yeah.
And then in the fall we're going to Portugal. So there's information about that's in there as well. So if you want to get my free newsletter, you can just sign up there. It's a really nice way to kind of get a sense of all the things I'm doing.
Yeah, it's as I was looking at all of the things that you do, I wonder, well, how the heck does he have time to do this gardening?
Well, I have a very good partner in my wife, and she loves the garden too, so that helps a lot.
Oh man. And had one other question here, and it's completely slipped my mind. I'm sorry for that. Well, how's the book doing?
Well, it hasn't come out yet.
I only got it yesterday.
That's right. You can pre-order it, certainly going on like Amazon or some places like that. You can pre-order it. But it officially comes out February 3rd, so in a couple weeks. It'll be out, and then I'll be doing talks all around the country. I'll be out in Seattle at the Flower Show and a lot of garden club talks and things of that nature, talking all about continuous vegetable gardening.
Well, you are a good talker, I'll tell you that. Charlie, it has been so much fun to talk with you today. I really appreciate the time you took to be with us, a whole hour to talk here, and I hope we have a chance to do this again and talk down the road. Maybe you'll have something else coming out, or you want to talk about something else. You're always welcome here on Garden Talk. Thanks,
well,
Charlie.
Thank you for having me, Larry. It's been a lot of fun.
Charlie Nardozzi, a nationally recognized garden writer, is a speaker, as you heard, radio and TV work. His latest book, the main title is The Continuous Vegetable Garden, and the subtitle is Create a Perpetual Food Garden That Sows and Grows Itself. It's really, he has some wonderful illustrations of how he has his beds set up, which I think is fascinating and easy. Then when you see the diagrams and the illustrations, it's pretty easy to, I think, follow what he's got going on with his own garden and what you could have going on with your garden as well. Great to have him with us. And again, next week, Melinda Meyer's back for Garden Talk to look at selecting houseplants for every room in your house. You know, there's lots of different shade and light issues depending on the room. And she'll also talk about how to grow great tomatoes. Thank you so much for listening. A big thanks, of course, to our team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.